Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Senate Judiciary Committee hearings have begun on the nomination of Samuel Alito to the Supreme Court. Lawmakers are making opening statements today. Questioning of Judge Alito begins tomorrow. The hearings are expected to continue for much of the week and will involve issues ranging from abortion rights to executive power to civil rights. President Bush had breakfast with Judge Alito this morning and said he hopes the hearings go smoothly.
The Supreme Court's a dignified body. Sam is a dignified person. And my hope, of course, is that the Senate bring dignity to the process.
Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy is a key Democrat on the Judiciary Committee who's indicating he does not want the hearings to go that smoothly. Earlier today, Here and Now's Bob Oaks had a chance to speak with Kennedy about his concerns regarding Judge Alito's record.
You've said that, as far as you're concerned, Judge Alito has a steep hill to climb in these hearings. What do you mean by that?
He demonstrates a general hostility to individual plaintiffs. He has upheld executive and police power in times when it has been excessive, and he has favored large institutions and large corporations in a very, I think, unquestionable way. So we have to really look at his strong commitment to constitutional values and whether the average person is going to get a fair and even shake with this nominee.
Senator, you've raised the question of whether Judge Alito can leave behind his personal and political beliefs. What makes you wonder?
First, in 1985, he submitted to the Justice Department a very elaborate memoranda about his constitutional and personal beliefs on constitutional issues. I mean, I haven't seen a document like that outside of Judge Bork's writings. And in that memoranda, he had a variety of different positions. One of them, for example, was in opposition to what we call the one man, one vote series of decisions of the Warren Court that really has been the basis of equal representation in congressional districts all over the country. And that was a very, very important a judgment that moved us towards a more democratic and open and fair society. He's had that position. He has also stated that he could not find in the Constitution any legality, any constitutional standard that would permit a woman to make independent decisions about her reproductive organs. And he has stated that clearly, not only as his own strong personal belief, but as a matter of law. I was troubled by two other items in that job application. One was his association with a club at Princeton that he took a sense of pride in being a member of that excluded women, those that were disabled, and also those that were blacks.
Do you think that as a Supreme Court Justice, Sam Alito will interpret the Constitution with a fair and open mind?
The concerns that we have on the basis of his writings and his decisions is he has acceded to the executive authority and power. There is a consistent record of that. And we are at a time in American constitutional history where the President of the United States is taking excessive action, whether it's in the areas of torture, whether it is in holding American citizens behind bars and denying them the right to counsel, which was overturned by Justice O'Connor, or whether it is on the area of spying on Americans. And the real question is going to be, will Judge Alito, with his background, his experience, his statements about what he calls a unitary presidency, that's an all-powerful presidency, how does that fit into our constitutional framework?
Last question and bottom line, Senator. Given all your concerns, are you ready to vote against him or to filibuster against the nomination?
I want to hear his answers. That's what the hearings are really all about. I don't think anyone deserves to be put on the Supreme Court. I think people have to earn it. And the way they earn it is convince the American people during the course of the hearings, we've got to get it right. This is our one chance. This nominee is going to be on the Supreme Court for another 30 or 40 years. So it's important that we get it right. And that's what I'm committed to try to do.
Massachusetts Democratic Senator Edward Kennedy is a member of the Judiciary Committee. He spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes. For the second week in a row, the White House is making an effort to get out ahead of the week's economic news. On Friday, the Commerce Department will release numbers from December retail sales, which are expected to show a 1% jump over November. Meantime, many congressional leaders say they're going to miss the man who, for the past 3 years, provided unbiased analysis of the federal budget despite increasing partisanship in Washington. Douglas Holtz Aiken became director of the Congressional Budget Office in 2003. He was the first director to come to the CBO from the White House, where he held the post of chief economist for the President's Council of Economic Advisers. That concerned some Democrats at the time, but eventually it was some Republicans who became annoyed with what the New York Times calls Holtz Aiken's startlingly straight talk about the record federal deficit, spending, and tax cuts. In a 2004 interview, he described his job to Here and Now.
I don't think the job of the CBO director is to make friends. Our job is to avoid the politics and do the numbers.
Douglas Holtz Aiken recently began his new job as director of the Center for Geoeconomic Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and we've invited him to look back and ahead at the economy and the politics surrounding it. He joins us on the line from his new office in Washington, D.C. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be back.
When you hear yourself, as you said in 2004, that your job as CBO director was not to make friends, what do you think about that?
Well, it's a fairly blunt way to say it, but it captured what I hope is the inner compass of any CBO director, which is to not keep score with regard to your friends on Capitol Hill or the parties on Capitol Hill, but to keep score in a different way, which is with regard to the quality of the analysis and what the data are telling us about the economy and the budget. And hopefully I held true to that compass. I sure thought it was my job to. And certainly I think the CBO best serves the Congress if the director does that.
Mm-hmm. Did you make enemies because of that compass?
In the end, you disappoint people, you anger people. What you hope is that you don't surprise people. I think it's fair that politicians at times become frustrated. They want to pursue their policy agendas. There are moments when the CBO's analyses stand to make that much more difficult, and that can be frustrating. But I would hope that they don't feel blindsided.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about some of the things facing the U.S. right now. Things have changed quite dramatically. We now have money necessary for hurricane relief, for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And you've said that you can't grow your way out of these huge fiscal challenges. What do you mean by that?
It means that while in the years 2001, 2002, even 2003, you could make a case that a big chunk of the federal budget deficit was due to the fact that the economy was performing below its potential. People were unemployed. We had very weak commercial real estate investment, for example. Those days are gone. The economy, while it might not be operating literally at the peak of its potential, is very close, and there's a modest amount of budgetary improvement that will come from simply growing a bit faster. Instead, the bulk of what will happen going forward will be dictated by the policy choices that Congress and the administration make. And the notion that somehow you could just grow your way out of this problem, just stick to what we've got and it'll get better on its own, or somehow stimulate the economy to solve your budget problems, I think is really misleading to policymakers.
Do you make any recommendations in terms of policy changes about what should happen to improve the economy?
I think that the major thing for everyone to keep in mind is that you could imagine a world in which an enormous amount of political blood was spilled over the course of taxes over the next 5 years, whether dividends and capital gains rates will go up or not. You could worry about how much exactly is spent in Iraq, which is $60, $70 billion a year at the moment. You could worry about exactly what's spent on things like Katrina and Rita. You could hold non-defense discretionary spending flat over the next 5 years. You could; those are all things that could consume the American public and the political apparatus, and you might even, in the process, get the budget back to balance in some through some really heroic efforts. And if you did that, you would wake up in 2010 with an enormous fiscal policy problem, which is that baby boom retires, Social Security spending goes up, Medicare and Medicaid spending goes up. So it's probably not worth having that fight. Instead, have the big fight on Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, figure out what those programs should look like and can look like in the 21st century and be manageable, and then figure out the rest. Mm-hmm. That would be my advice.
So it's Medicare and Social Security. Those things have to get under control.
There's no way around that. That's, I think, genuinely an issue of political leadership, and it will be the mantle of the next generation of political leaders, whether they can pick up and lead on Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. That's a litmus test.
Do we need to raise taxes?
We might need to. If we go on spending the kinds of money we do are planning to in health care, especially in Social Security, it may be inevitable that we raise taxes.
I'm wondering, what about these types of things and controlling the spending and the deficit and all of this, and where that puts the U.S. in terms of a global position in economic terms?
The U.S. remains way ahead of everybody. Mm-hmm. The attention paid to China and India is deserved, but I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that China and India overtake the United States. It's a matter of the decisions that we make here in order to preserve the advantages we have.
Mm-hmm. And what would have to be done to preserve some of those advantages?
Recipe for growth is, in the end, boringly simple. You must sacrifice in the present to accumulate for the future, so we need to save more as a nation, plow those savings into the kinds of things that allow you to produce more. Smarter people, so educate and make sure our schools work, train workers for specialized skills. And finally, the nuts and bolts. Are there factories, and is there equipment in those factories making the investments necessary?
Well, when I hear that, I'm just wondering, you earlier said that you didn't want to disappoint people and really have any huge surprises among people. I'm wondering, though, from your perspective, it must have been at times frustrating or disappointing and maybe sometimes even surprising to have to deal with the policymakers and sort of have that sense of limbo and uncertainty about what you were trying to accomplish.
Well, is it the case that as a trained economist, I found myself disappointed at times with what policymakers chose? Absolutely. Was it frustrating at times? Absolutely. But I think we should all be very afraid of a world in which the economists are happy. that's probably not where we want to end up.
Douglas Holtz Aiken was, until recently, the director of the Congressional Budget Office. He's now the director of the Center for Geoeconomic Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. The last 4 days in Iraq have been among the deadliest for U.S. troops since the war began. This morning, two suicide bombers attacked a ceremony marking National Police Day that was taking place in Baghdad's heavily fortified government zone. At least 29 people were killed. Meantime, 12 Americans are now confirmed dead after a U.S. Black Hawk military helicopter crashed in northern Iraq. Joining us on the line with the latest from Baghdad is Los Angeles Times correspondent Borzu Deragahi. Welcome, and can you describe this area, Borzu, where the helicopter crash occurred and what happened?
Talofer is a mountainous area, actually, of northern Iraq, where this crash occurred. And apparently there was some very bad weather at the time that this was happening. It was just before midnight, so there was darkness, bad weather, really serious combination of complications when it comes to flying a helicopter, according to experts that I've spoken to, that this kind of condition makes an emergency landing in case of an engine failure just that much more complicated with a helicopter.
There have been about 24 fatal helicopter crashes in Iraq since the U.S. invasion began there in March of 2003, some of them because of hostile fire, some of them accidental.
Yeah, you know, there's been a various different types of ways that helicopters have been downed here. Sometimes it's because of mechanical error. Sometimes it's because of bad weather conditions. You know, the sandstorms get into the gears of the helicopters that were generally designed for the wet climates of Western Europe and the Cold War. So that's kind of one of the complicating things about the using helicopters in a desert environment. Another thing about the helicopters is that because of the ground fire, because of the danger for ground fire from surface-to-air missiles and rocket-propelled grenades, the helicopter pilots tend to fly very low, and that creates its own complications. You got to be very, very alert to be careful for power lines and other such obstructions.
Borzu, let's move on to the police ceremony today. What happened?
Well, apparently there was suicide bombers who approached the entrance to the Interior Ministry compound. They were not able to get in, but they did manage to blow themselves up, taking out about at least a dozen Iraqi police officers, just more and more violence directed at Iraq's security forces. No one of any high rank was hurt at all.
What's the reaction been like from military officials there?
Well, I think the U.S. is definitely concerned about an escalation of hostilities between the Iraq's minority Sunni Arabs that make up the insurgency and the dominant Shiites and Kurds. There's been a real worry that these two broad kind of groups have had their last chance at reconciling between themselves in this election, and you know the election might have created more problems than solved. The elections took place December 15th, listeners may remember, and you know the Shiites generally trounce the Sunnis in this election. And I know that on the political end, the U.S. is putting pressure on the dominant Shiites and Kurds to bring those Sunni Arabs into the government. So there's definitely that worry.
Mm-hmm. And when we talk about diplomatic efforts, can you explain what's happening on that front and how those efforts are progressing and trying to resolve some of the conflict diplomatically?
Well, I mean, on one level, you have, for example, Michael Ware of Time magazine reported last month that the diplomats, American diplomats and military commanders are trying to talk to the Sunni Arab insurgents that are more nationalist rather than religious fundamentalist and foreign fighters and try to get them to turn against the foreign fighters. So that's one approach. Another approach is to, talk to them, have the invite the Sunni leader or the Shiite leader or the Kurdish leader over to the embassy and just have a chat with them and express to them what the U.S. wants and what the U.S. would like to see. Is that sort of forcing them to do something? I don't think so. But it is definitely putting pressure on them to create what the U.S. Demands, which is a broad-based government that includes all of Iraq's diverse ethnic, sectarian, and ideological strains.
Mm-hmm. And in return, what did the Sunni Arabs get for this?
Well, I think the hard part of convincing at this point is not so much the Sunni Arabs, or it's the Sunni Arabs as much as it is the Shiites, who are dead set on cutting out certain strains in the Iraqi body politic from this emerging political order. So trying to get both people to join in. But I guess what they would get is a seat at the table, a piece of the action. Whether that's patronage, jobs, or future participation at the highest level of the government, proportionate to their population. Just not to be totally ostracized is what they would get out of it.
Mm-hmm. And when will we know more about some of the election results?
Well, you got to consider that right now it's on the eve of Eid al-Adha, which is the Muslim feast during the time of the Hajj to Mecca. So everything just shut down for like an extremely long weekend. You're going to have basically a 5-day holiday starting tonight. So there's not going to be much action going on until next week.
And would it be as early as next week, do you think?
Yeah, as early as next week, there'll be some announcements. I've always thought this, and I'm willing to say this, I've always thought this election dispute thing was a red herring. You know, maybe a few votes will change here and there, maybe a couple hundred ballot boxes with about 500 votes each in them will be canceled because of allegations of fraud or proven suspicions of fraud. But it's not going to change the result of the election, which have already been reported.
All right. Borzu, thanks very much for speaking with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Borzu Deragahi is a correspondent for the Los Angeles Times in Baghdad. As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from. Tomorrow on Here and Now, a school system is offering movie coupons and other incentives to students who test clean for drugs. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The master plan on rebuilding New Orleans is expected to be released later this week. It comes as 47,000 displaced residents are still asking for help finding housing. Immediately following Hurricane Katrina, people across the country reached out to those displaced by the storm, in some cases opening their homes to evacuees. Several websites popped up advertising places either for free or for rent. As generous as these offers may have been, it turns out some of the ads weren't exactly welcoming. In fact, a few were explicitly racist. James Perry heads the Greater New Orleans Fair Housing Action Center, a nonprofit civil rights group, and James joins us from a studio in New Orleans. Welcome.
Thank you.
Can you tell us what some of these ads said?
Sure. They were pretty interesting. One of the ones that most sparked my interest was one that says, not to be racist, but no blacks. There's another one that says that they're opening their home to a Christian family and that their neighborhood isn't accepting of blacks, so no blacks. And they kind of go all over the map. So there are some that say no whites. There are some that say gays only. There are some that say no gays.
So they're blatant. They're unbelievable.
Really straightforward. And it was really surprising for us because most of these kind of advertising cases in housing discrimination had been dealt with years ago. And so we really didn't see this kind of blatant stuff. The thing that we still see often is no kids. We'll see that quite often. But we won't see references to race anymore because these things have been litigated and we thought solved, but obviously not.
So what was your reaction? Did you think it was like a joke or something?
Well, I didn't, but it's funny that you asked that because I immediately showed the advertisements to our general counsel, and she thought that I was playing a practical joke on her because she really just didn't believe that someone would realistically say this. The first ad that I showed her said, we don't want to confuse our children, so whites only.
Oh my gosh.
She just couldn't believe it.
Right.
So we were all shocked.
And what about the folks who called to complain? What was their reaction?
The initial complaint came from someone who we actually have known for some time. And so she couldn't believe it herself. And she conferred with her husband, who happens to be a civil rights attorney, and he couldn't believe it. And so and he called me just to see, is this real?
Mm-hmm. So, and I'm wondering, did they face actual discrimination or did they just see the ads and steer clear? Or did some folks actually try to pursue it and address the folks who posted the ads?
Well, we haven't gotten any calls from anyone who actually attempted to rent one of the apartments or tried to use one of the dwellings. And I think it's because the ads were so blatant. But the Fair Housing Law is pretty extensive in that it provides that a person doesn't have to apply for housing if it's been made very, very clear that they don't qualify because of their race, religion, or some other protected class status. So people have protection even though there's only been an advertisement and they haven't actually been denied housing.
So this is very serious. I mean, there are laws here that we're talking about. There are very strict rules about exactly how this happens. It's also got a bit of a twist to it because this is on the Internet.
Right. It's a new frontier. You know, I mentioned earlier that we thought a lot of this had been resolved, and it had been resolved. There have been big cases against a lot of very large newspapers around the country who have since learned their lesson, and they don't publish these discriminatory advertisements. A lot of times they will have staff who sit there and review to make sure that they're not engaging in any discriminatory publishing. But so this is new. It's the Internet. There aren't many cases out there that apply strictly to the Internet. What we're thinking, though, is that the newspaper cases will apply. Those precedents will apply here to the Internet.
And so the websites involved are actually the ones responsible for the content.
The websites themselves are responsible, and the individuals who posted the ads are responsible.
I'm wondering if it's clear that the websites involved, did they realize that they were doing something illegal, and what was their reaction?
The reaction was varied. We sent letters and filed administrative complaints against the websites on December 23rd. A few of them have said, well, we have our attorneys looking into it. KatrinaHome.com took their entire website down. KatrinaHousing.org put up a filter process, and they've also put up a system so that people can note discriminatory advertisements and immediately have them pulled from the website. You know, specifically in New Orleans, when you look at the people who needed help, it's a majority African-American city, and so the majority of these discriminatory ads said no African-Americans. The greatest deed would have been to help all people rather than to deny specific groups and specific protected classes.
And are there penalties for those discriminatory statements?
Under the Federal Fair Housing Act, any person who's been discriminated against can enforce their right to fair housing, and they can seek damages for any way that they have been harmed by the act of the person who engaged in discrimination. And those damages, depending upon the type of case, have ranged from, you know, the thousands to hundreds of thousands and into the millions. And so it just really depends on the facts of a particular case.
Mm-hmm. We should say on a lighter note, some of the ads also sound like a dating service almost. There was an example of a man looking to offer room to a divorced woman who was willing to marry him.
Right.
<Hey.
And laughs> there are a few laughs there. And, you know, we don't know what to make of those, and we don't know how serious some people were in providing housing to evacuees. But that being said, it still goes back to this issue that when the ads had a discriminatory statement, it was simply inappropriate.
Mm-hmm. You know, we're making light of this in a way and sort of saying this was an unbelievable thing, almost considered a joke to a certain degree. And this whole Hurricane Katrina, the whole storm and its coverage have sort of revealed real racial inequities in our country. I'm wondering, as a person who works on civil rights issues, what's your reaction to all this? Do you look at it and say, maybe things aren't really changing as much as I thought?
Yeah, because, you know, and this is, I think, really interesting. One thing that I've heard said many times is that the media coverage of Katrina really brought to light the racial inequities, specifically in urban America. And it made some people realize how much alive racism is. Some of those very people who saw that stuff, who still placed these advertisements and still had the thought to say, well, we want to help evacuees, but no blacks. Or we want to help evacuees, but know this or know that. And so, you know, I don't know if we've really made the stride, that I would have hoped we would have made. You know, if there would have been one great thing that could have been achieved by all the sacrifice and pain caused by Hurricane Katrina, it would be that we had come to some realization about racial inequities in America. But perhaps these Internet advertisements say that we haven't quite achieved that. We haven't quite gotten that out of this horrible problem of Hurricane Katrina.
Well, James Perry heads the Greater New Orleans Fair Housing Action Center. He's investigating discriminatory ads that appeared on the Internet offering housing to Hurricane Katrina victims. Thanks for joining us, James.
Thank you.
Still to come, a filmmaker presents an unvarnished take on growing up in rural America. It's called Country Boys. You're listening to Here and Now. Funerals for three of the men killed in a West Virginia mine last week are scheduled today. Six miners were laid to rest yesterday. Most of these services are private affairs. The media has been asked not to intrude, but the spotlight remains on West Virginia. Cameras were rolling last week when the miners' families were told most of the men had survived the explosion inside the Sago mine. Hours later, they found out 12 of the 13 men had died. A sign outside a West Virginia donut shop today says healing is hard. Joining us to talk about the grieving process is nationally syndicated health columnist Judy Foreman, who is in the studio with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
You're writing about grief in
yes.
your column today, and the latest research about the grieving process is that there's really no normal process.
That's right. It's really messy. It doesn't go by stages. There's no right or wrong way to do it. And what you said in the beginning, closure is sort of a myth. I mean, people think they should get to closure and move on right away. There may be no such thing as closure.
You actually cite research in your column that says it's not really, shouldn't be all that debilitating, though.
Yes and no. I mean, there's sort of almost no shouldn'ts. That for about half the people in some studies, they get depressed, like clinically depressed, and half don't. Presumably, everybody is sad at some level, but to turn that into clinical depression is not necessary. Some people that happens to, some it doesn't, but it's a very individual process.
So then, is there any general advice you can give to people who are going through the grieving process?
Well, I think sort of honor your own way of dealing with it. And if you're crying a lot, that's probably normal. And if you're not crying, that's probably normal too. Talk to people, talk to your friends. If necessary, talk to a counselor. But in general, in a way, throw out the books. Just do your own process because that's probably what's right for you.
I know I've heard some people say that when they're grieving, they maintain a relationship
yes.
with the deceased. They even maybe keep an answering machine recording of the deceased. On the answering machine to sort of still hear their voice. Now, maybe nothing's normal, but what about unhealthy? Where do we cross the line into unhealthy? Is that unhealthy?
Well, according to the experts that I talked to, no, that's not unhealthy. In fact, I have a friend who, after his wife died, he said he was in constant contact, talked to her every day. And in fact, one of the people I spoke to for this article said that she wished she had recorded her husband's voice. I'm not sure on the answering machine callers to hear, but for herself to hear and for her kids to hear. So recording your loved one's voice, taking lots of pictures, writing things down, even interviewing them for their thoughts so that you can keep them for posterity. I think all those things are healthy. And talking to the person, apparently there's no evidence at all that that is dangerous or unhealthy.
And what about when the process is a long, drawn-out process, a death or a sudden death? Is there a difference there?
That is a really good question, and the research is not totally clear. It used to be kind of the pop psych view that if you did anticipatory grieving, like if you knew someone was going to die and you kind of grieved along the way, that that would make the final sort of quote-unquote real grieving process easier. But that didn't seem to clearly be the case because when the person really dies, it's always a shock. It's always more than you expect, even if you've been expecting it for years. So there's no clear advice on whether you can sort of pay now and be free later. It just seems to be very, very idiosyncratic.
And also emotional when someone does realize that they are moving on.
Yes, that's perhaps the saddest thing for me in researching this column was this young mother who lost her baby and then she realized she had gone for 15 minutes without thinking of the baby. And she recognized that truthfully as a sign of sort of moving on with her life. But that was devastating to realize she was, in a way, letting go.
So when there's a very public kind of grieving thing going on, like we're seeing in West Virginia right now with the funerals of these miners. Is it more difficult or perhaps easier for the folks involved in this very public grieving process?
Yeah, I don't know exactly what research there's been on the public versus the private grieving, but I do know from the research when a whole group of people gets killed, like when there's a community grief, essentially, all the professionals want to send in grief counselors and kind of do it the professional way. And from what I know, that's not necessarily really helpful. What really is healing is the community itself, is the neighbors bringing casseroles and coming to sit for the evening. It's people kind of collectively helping to heal each other, not professionally, but with the strength of their own community. Sometimes their churches, sometimes their bingo games, whatever. That for a community grief process, it's the people helping each other.
Judy, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
Judy Foreman is a nationally syndicated health columnist. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. With images of rural life still fresh in many Americans' minds after the mining tragedy in West Virginia, the new documentary Country Boys starts airing on PBS tonight. The documentary looks at the lives of two adolescent boys over three critical years when they're straddling who they were born as and who they might become. Filmmaker David Sutherland interweaves the boys' stories about growing up in eastern Kentucky and coping with pain and poverty. In this scene, one of the boys, Chris, reacts nervously as his parents tell him his mother is leaving.
I can live here and me and Randall can fight 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm. I know. I told you.
We get along better when we ain't living together. A whole lot better. We don't fight.
Yeah, I knew that.
And it's just better that way.
This ain't no long-term thing, is it?
Just for a while. Just for a break.
And David Sutherland joins us in studio to tell us more about this film. David, how did you find these two boys, Chris and Cody? Let's start with Chris.
I started going to classes at the school, and one day I walked into the wrong, opened the wrong door, entered, and there's this kid that has a vocabulary that's more sophisticated and he's more articulate in general than maybe any teacher I ever had in high school. And he's a first-rate con man. What really made me decide how great he was is when I went to his hollow, which is, well, you know, a hollow is like it's a cul-de-sac with, say, 30, 40 trailers in it or something like that. You know, it's very poor circumstances, and he was so proud of it. His face just lit up, just being there. He said he felt so safe. Cody happened by accident. I had chosen this kid, Joe Rose, but Joe decided just before filming he was switching to the public high school where I couldn't get permission to film. So I had been through all the kids at school, and finally I just said to Joe, do you know any kids that would be really interesting? He said, there's one kid, a new kid coming to the school. I've heard him play music, and I would pay anything to just hear what his story is. So I met Cody. And the interesting thing is, I didn't know Cody's backstory, which was that his father had shot himself and his seventh wife, and how he found religion, and which really defines him.
Well, let's listen to a clip of that right now. Cody actually sings about his father.
Well, I was 12 years old without a father.
I wrote a song about my dad, about how he died. You know, I'm not going to see him again. It's horrible.
Two shots to the chest. Flesh hits the wall.
He really idolizes his father throughout this.
He does, and he talks about actually how he misses his father every day, and then when he finally does graduate at the end of the film, laments that his father wasn't there to see it. One thing I should say about both these kids, when you make choices in who's going to be your protagonist, you have to be very concerned about, will they see it through to the end? And my time frame was the last 3 years of high school. And if they don't graduate, I thought, you know, or they do, I had thought there was a good chance at least one of them would. But then you also need access to the parents, because you can long-form documentary, if all of a sudden somebody pulls out and says you can't film anymore, then what are you following? I trust my instincts, and I knew that Chris would see it through. And there was, I had no doubt about Cody. But then with the families, it got trickier.
When you talk about the families of these two boys and Randall, the alcoholic father of Chris, he lived with his father, his grandmother, and at times his mother, though she did leave in the film as well. And but she plays quite a significant role in the documentary. Let's first just listen to a brief clip of her story.
Randall's real sick and eventually won't be around. My kids know it. I've told them that it's going to happen, but just don't know when. Just got to wait.
We can wheel and deal and work out something.
You got to have money. And someone had to pick up
slack.
And it was me. Me cleaning hotels been the main source of income.
Why did you decide to give her such a prominent role?
I actually never decide anything, to be honest. She played a prominent role. She kept things together. And as the film progresses, some people have said maybe she goes bad, but I never look at anybody going bad or good. It's all nuance. Nothing's black and white.
Also in the film, when we talk about Cody, he wants to be a rock star. We heard a little bit of his music. His girlfriend's father sings country songs. I'm wondering if maybe a motivation for their participation in the film was maybe to get a little bit of exposure for the music.
Yes. Well, both kids, first of all, said that they were doing the film because I don't pay them, because it might be interesting and they were bored anyhow. But Cody also said it might get his band out there and it might be a way to get them heard. Ray Riddle, it was a little bit different.
Ray Riddle is Cody's,
girlfriend's father, who's now his father-in-law. Ray's the real thing. He's a major, major talent. And in West Virginia, when I was touring through West Virginia looking for subjects with preachers, and I saw in holler after holler, these kids are so hip about the outside world through satellite dishes. They might share a computer, but they're better than a lot. I had 230 interns on this film, and they're more sophisticated than many of them because there's not a lot of opportunity there.
When you do a film like this, I think it's probably, I would guess, a line that you have to walk between being objective and then crossing a line maybe and saying, look at these poor people. How do you walk that line and strike a balance?
I know on a film like this that these two kids can't stand for all of Appalachia. It's different. West Virginia looks like the 1930s. Eastern Kentucky doesn't all look like, it looks a lot like where Cody lives at Liz's, because Western Kentucky's affluent. So there's trickle-down theory of money coming from the West, the affluent part, into the Eastern Kentucky. And so a lot of those stereotypes still exist in some of the towns. I've lived all over. I've lived around poverty. I lived with different families. My feeling about it is that if you spend 7 years coming back to this place, and I had four people pull guns to my head, not out of meanness. I was on their private property in West Virginia and Eastern Kentucky, and the people were sweet. They just didn't know who I was, whatever. And I've been in hollers that people from around there won't go to. And the people are sweet. And if I'm nuts enough to do that, and I don't cause any trouble, and, you know, if people have illegal electrical wiring, that's what they worry about because no one's got any money, you know, will the police come and pull out their wiring? If you know that and things like that, people get used to you. And over 7 years, I could get get a card there in some of the hollers. I could become a resident.
Well, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
David Sutherland's film Country Boys is scheduled to air as part of the Frontline series on PBS stations around the country beginning tonight. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.